The year is 224 days long. The sun rises in the west and sets in the east. From sunrise to sunset is about 243 days. A runaway greenhouse gas effect keeps the temperature to about 860 or 900 degrees Fahrenheit, which some astronomers have called a warning about the possible future of Earth. The place at hand is Earth's nearest planetary neighbor, Venus, and we're learning a lot more about it every day. I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air. With me is Sanjay LeMay, distinguished scientist with the UW Space Science and Engineering Center. With William Sheehan, he is the co-author of the book Venus, to be published in July 2022 by Reaction Books Limited. And welcome back to University of the Air. It's been 10 years since your last visit, I believe.
Thank you, Norman. It's a pleasure to be back, and I'm glad we are talking about Venus. It's still in the news.
Yes, it is. You know, I mean, if you're a young astronomer looking with your relatively modest telescope at Venus, there's really nothing new to see from day to day, or should I say night to night, or is there?
Well, you know, amateurs have done amazing things, and with new technology, new cameras, and image processing technology, they're able to see a lot of detail. You know, believe it or not, they can even image the night side emissions from Venus, from the surface and the lower atmosphere. And sometimes you see strange things which they can't explain, and then we look at corresponding spacecraft images and see if the spacecraft saw something interesting or not. So amateurs are still playing a crucial role in planetary astronomy.
The morning star and the evening star, because it is inside of our orbit, closer to the sun, does it ever change color upon casual viewing?
For casual viewing, no. And the one problem is that the planet is so bright that it's difficult for the human eye to make out its color. It looks brilliant white at its brightest, like it is about right now in the morning sky. And we can't even make it out that it's seen as a crescent. It's rare that just because of the orbits of Venus and Earth, we don't see it as a full moon, for example. But some people have seen the crescent. But because of its brightness, and the brightness is, of course, highest when Venus is closest to Earth, it's difficult to make out the color. But some people have said that it looks kind of yellowish, and that's what led to the idea of, that the garlic color of Venus was due to some sulfur clouds or sulfur-bearing clouds. But beyond that, we haven't been able to really see changes in color. If you look at Venus through polarized glasses, like, you know, your polaroids that you wear normally to cut back on the sunlight, then you can see some detail. But change in color is faint. It's possible there's a very faint change in color because the contrast do change. But nothing significant, not as dramatic like on Jupiter or Saturn.
Does it have full phases like our moon?
Yes, it does. And in fact, that was Galileo's discovery. You know, she has phases, and that's what led to advances in telescope technology, and other people started looking at Venus, and we learned a lot in the last four centuries. But yes, you do see phases of Venus, and some amateurs have actually captured the series from the morning crescent to the evening crescent.
The phases of our moon are caused by the Earth's shadow. What are the phases of Venus caused by?
Well, it's just a viewing geometry, you know, where the sun is and where Earth is.
Okay, because sometimes Venus is actually, I guess, farther from the Earth than...
when it's on the other side of the sun, that's when we cannot see Venus because the sun obscures the visibility because the sun is so bright. But when it's closer to Earth, the sun, the planet is lit from the backside, so to speak, from where we are. So that's why we see the crescent.
And you see Venus, let's assume a clear sky at some desert location perhaps. Would you always be able to see Venus as the morning star and the evening star, regardless of where it is in its orbit?
Well, you know, I mean, depending on where it is in the orbit, it's either a morning star or an evening star. But yes, you can even see it in the daylight if you have clear skies and you know where to look. You can see the planet, yes.
Now, of late, there has been a lot of interest, even some movies about going to Mars and talk about, well, how habitable is it for people or how might it be made relatively habitable, but no such talk about
terraforming.
no such talk about Venus.
Well, Venus has a very massive atmosphere of carbon dioxide compared to Mars. It's almost, 10,000 times thicker, and so it'll take a lot of energy to change that atmosphere into something that's conducive for human life, but then you have to worry about the temperature. So it's a fantasy. The retiring scientist from chief scientist of NASA, Jim Green, he recently talked about terraforming planets, Mars, and even Venus. But I think it's a fantasy, in my opinion.
Why all this great interest in Venus all of a sudden, though? It seems as if there's a real burgeoning of missions to Venus.
Well, you know, the space age began, at least the planetary exploration age began, with the first flight to Venus. The first successful mission was Mariner 2 way back in 1962. But the Soviet Union was also trying to get to Venus, and at that point there was a Cold War, and, the two nations were trying to outdo each other, so to speak, in space after the launch of Sputnik. Now, the first ideas about Venus cloud started to form more than a century ago. And Ross, an astronomer who was at Yerkes Observatory and also later on in California, he obtained images of Venus. And in those images, he could see some patches taken through the blue filter that were eventually showed a rotation period of about 4 days. It was not known then. But many decades later. But we still don't know what causes those light and dark patches, the contrast, as we call them. And they have been a mystery, even though we have sent many probes, even balloons, to explore the atmosphere. And more than 24 candidates have been proposed basic chemicals. And they didn't seem quite right to explain what we observed in terms of the behavior of those patches, how they change, what their time evolution is like, etc. And so a few years ago, I followed up on some ideas about possibility of life in the clouds of Venus, and we just conjectured whether some bacteria could be causing those contrasts. And that was based on my certainly becoming educated about the spectral properties of bacteria. It turns out this is a bacterium called ferrooxidans that's found in copper mines on Earth. It lives in very acidic conditions, sulfuric acid, as a matter of fact. And it has an absorption spectrum that's not very different from what Venus looks like in absorption. It has a UV absorption peak just around 365 nanometers. And so the idea seemed worth exploring, and I talked to some of my colleagues. I was on a field trip in northern India, in Ladakh, at about 5,000 meters. And that's where the idea gelled that in my mind when we were exploring a lake, a high-altitude lake, and suddenly a wind gust came, and I saw some white salt dust getting picked up from the surface and getting lifted up into the air. And that was my Eureka moment. Could something have happened on Venus? And so that led to a paper, and then that triggered some excitement. So that also was added on by the recent discovery or potential discovery of a strange gas, phosphine, which is a very poisonous gas, and it's not expected on Venus. And these astronomers found it, found a signature in some ground-based data. And when they got, they published the paper, they considered if it could be produced on Venus and could it be stable or could it be something else. And they couldn't find any mechanism where it could be, how it could be produced geochemically on the planet. And so that left open the possibility of life. And so that created quite a bit of controversy and, of course, excitement.
At what point in the atmosphere would these organisms be able to survive?
Well, as you mentioned earlier, the surface temperature is quite high on the surface, but it, as you go up in altitude, roughly every 1.6 kilometer or 1 mile, it changes, it decreases by about 12 to 15 degrees centigrade. So if you're above, say, 48 kilometers or roughly 30 miles above the surface, the temperature is low enough where bacteria can survive, as we have found on Earth. By the way, the first extremophiles, or thermophiles as they're called, you know, bacteria that can live in extreme temperatures, extreme high temperatures, they were discovered by Tom Brock, who just recently passed away about a year ago, and he was on the faculty here on this campus. But he was in Indiana University, I believe, when he discovered those in Yellowstone Park in...
in geysers?
In geysers, correct. The blue algae.
Yes, you would think that would be an inhospitable environment for life, and yet life is much more versatile than than we imagined some time ago.
And so he was on a vacation, I think, in summertime in 1970 or 71, I believe. And he went back after he had seen the blue algae the following year and then took some samples and detected bacteria. And so that's when we first came to know about extremophiles.
These probes looking at Venus, most of them have been flybys of some kind?
The early ones were flybys, like Mariner 2, Venera, but the Soviets, they deployed a probe into the atmosphere, Venera 4. And then they had many probes after that, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, and then came two balloons. So some of them returned some significant information. Venera 8, for example, even detected ammonia, another gas that's not expected on Venus. And in fact, that led to a paper by two American chemists who said it simply couldn't exist on Venus, and people sort of dropped the idea of ammonia. But going back and looking at some of the data from Pioneer Venus mass spectrometer that entered the atmosphere in 1978, one of my colleagues and I looked at that data, and we do find some possibility of ammonia in the atmosphere.
And what's exciting about that?
Well, there's a third gas, even methane, and that's so there's a triad of these three gases which we don't, which should not exist on Venus, given what we know, or we think we know about Venus. And all of these gas, all three gases, are interesting in that they can be produced geochemically, or even through some meteorite impacts, possibly, like or they can also be created by biology. So what's the source? That's the mystery.
So they have cows on Venus, as it turns out.
Well, I don't know about that, but Sir Fred Hoyle in the 1930s, he had conjectured about petroleum on Venus. So, who knows? But then there are people who had thought that the petroleum came from meteor impacts, and there was a scientist, astronomer, who wanted to dig into the into a crater in Sweden to see if they could discover petroleum there. So, you know, people put out some ideas based on what they think they know, and then other people go and investigate and either prove them wrong or right. So the story continues with these three gases, ammonia, methane, and phosphine. And just this morning, somebody forwarded me a note that was published on the web that SOFIA, one of the airborne telescopes, it's a, I think, a fairly large telescope mounted in a converted Boeing 747. And they just looked at Venus to see if they could find any evidence of phosphine. So in a few months, we'll find out what the observations tell us.
Still too early to actually bring back samples, as has been done with the Moon and Mars?
Well, Mars, we are talking about bringing samples back. The Moon, of course, there have been many samples, most recently by the Chinese, and before that by the Americans from the Apollo program. Bringing back samples from Mars is a little more challenging, and there are also some problems to tackle with, you know, especially given with this recent crisis that we are having with COVID. How do you keep Earth from being contaminated by something from outer space?
Big question.
That's a major worry. So there are people who worry about this question, both forward contamination and backward contamination. That is, if you go send something to Mars, are you sending Earth life to Mars? And, of course, in the past, we have done that because it turns out that life is very tenacious. And recently, people discovered that even all the cleaning agents that are used to clean spacecraft to make them bacteria-proof don't work. There are some species which actually survive quite well under with those cleaning chemicals. So that's the first problem. And then the second is, if you bring something back, what if you end up contaminating the Earth's environment? So even though the current rover Perseverance is collecting samples and going to cache them and leave them on the surface of Mars, and another rover in the next decade will go and pick them up, it's not clear how or exactly where they will bring them to. Will they bring them to in space somewhere where they can be examined through a laboratory, or bring them down on the surface? I think that question is still not quite fully answered yet. But I'm not keeping up on the sample return from Mars, but we'll have to wait and find out how the plans develop.
Well, if it turns out that you're right about possibility of bacteria in the atmosphere of Venus, and some of that is scooped up, you would know that that's a life form of some kind that's very hardy, and you would want to be, I think, quite careful about bringing it to Earth, where it could perhaps live in any number of environments.
Yes. So that's quite right. Although Venus conditions are so extreme that they would find it very difficult to find a similar environment on Earth. You know, if the cloud droplets are made up of concentrated sulfuric acid, and we are still debating what the actual concentration is, but it could be very high, from 50-60% to as high as 85-90% or even more. But we don't know that yet, because just recently we've been discussing whether some salts could lower that acidity, something like ammonium sulfate or iron chloride. But there's something else to ponder. For Mars, the ideas about past life are based on the belief that Mars had liquid water for a long time. Now, whether or not liquid water existed on Venus, that's still under debate. People assume it was there, but that's not confirmed. And if life originated on Mars, if water was present for a long enough time for it to arise there itself, or it was brought there by impacts. Something similar could have happened on Venus. It could have also happened, transpermia. Life could have, it been ejected from Earth and brought to Mars, or the other way, from Mars to Earth. So if we now find life in samples from Mars, one question would be, is it Earth life that went to Mars either recently as with the spacecraft or a long time ago? But for Venus, it's a different situation because the contrasts have been seen for more than a century, long before the age of the spacecraft exploration. So we didn't send any bacteria to Venus that are causing those contrasts. That's the argument I have.
Well, let's look at the surface of Venus and get some idea of how Venus came to be the way it is today when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Sanjay LeMay, and we're talking about Venus, the planet, and what it's like and what we're finding out about it. How did Venus get to be the way it is today, this planet roughly the size of Earth, but just absolutely shrouded with heavy, heavy atmosphere and rampant greenhouse gases? How did it get to be that way in its evolution?
Well, that's the question that's driving the exploration. I wish we knew. The ideas of planet formation are still evolving. They change every decade or even sooner sometimes. When we go to school and learn that, yes, there are nine planets, and then suddenly we find there are only eight planets.
Yes, poor Pluto.
but then if you lived in the previous generation, there were things called minor planets. Well, what's a minor planet? It just shows that, as David Levy once remarked, solar system is still under construction. And it would have been wonderful to have been an observer when the planets were being formed. But we don't really know. I think because Earth and Venus are so close together, they roughly formed in a similar manner, basically planet symbols coalescing together and forming a planet. But they were very hot when they were initially formed, with a molten surface, and eventually they cooled and created a crust, and the interior remained hot. So both Venus and Mars have similar size. Both have iron cores. But we don't know much more beyond that. Why Earth ended up with so much water today, and whether Venus also had similar water or not, those are questions we are still debating. Last year, or just a few months ago, European team looked at some output from a model, and they assumed certain conditions at roughly 100 million years age for Venus.
Early on.
I mean, about 4.4 billion years ago. What was the sun like then? What would the surface have been like? What kind of atmosphere it had? And how that atmosphere would have evolved since then to the present day, or close to it. And they did it as a comparative study for Earth and Venus, and they found that according to or using their assumptions about the atmosphere, the surface pressure, thickness of the atmosphere, etc., how bright the sun was, kind of clouds, that water could never have condensed onto the surface. It remained a very warm atmosphere throughout. And so they published a paper claiming that Venus never had any oceans. Of course, if there were no oceans, there could be no life. Now, how did this concept that Venus had liquid water came about? Well, it happened because some of the early probes, like Pioneer Venus, they carried an instrument called a neutral mass spectrometer. And that instrument was able to sample the Venus atmosphere and determine the ratio of two isotopes of hydrogen, normal hydrogen, and its isotope deuterium, which is twice as heavy because it has an addition. It has one neutron along with a proton, so that makes it almost twice as heavy. And the deuterium is also found on Earth in the seawater, and its proportion is well known, and it's been measured at seawater at the sea level, and there's a standard called mean ocean water. And when they compared the amount of deuterium to hydrogen in the Venus atmosphere, they found that it was enriched compared to the Earth's atmosphere by almost 150 times. And if both Venus and Earth formed similarly, how do you enrich one planet in deuterium compared to the other? And the most logical explanation seemed to be that Venus had liquid water, and as the planet warmed up, some of the water was photodissociated into its components, hydrogen and oxygen. And same thing with deuterium. Deuterium also makes a form of water called heavy water, although I don't want to emphasize heavy because heavy water is actually tritium, which has two neutrons.
Of course.
So this is the light version of heavy water. Eventually, the water molecule breaks up into hydrogen and oxygen, and same thing with deuterium, into deuterium and oxygen. And the lighter oxygen escapes faster than the deuterium, and oxygen combines with the other chemicals like carbon to form carbon dioxide or sulfur dioxide or some other compounds. And then that's how you can enrich the atmosphere in deuterium. And so that idea was more or less accepted. Other people had suggested that maybe some impacts brought in different kind of water with the through comets, and that's why the composition was different. But it didn't seem plausible. So the most likeliest explanation was that Venus had liquid water, and most assumed that like Earth, it would have gone through a cool phase before the runaway greenhouse effect took over and warmed up the atmosphere. So Venus, most people sort of expected that had liquid water until this paper came out. So now people are trying to explore that question. Of course, they'll probably discover volcanoes, as are believed to be active, just like the Tonga explosion recently. That was massive. It was amazing.
Only probably on an even bigger scale.
In the past, possibly at the present time, maybe not so explosive, because then we would have seen some indications in the clouds.
Oh, we can, yes, we can see that.
We
well
can see them. We can, but there are unexplained observations from the past data that we can explain, like the Vega 1 lander. You know, the Vega was a complicated mission. Vega, by the way, it stands for Venus Halley, and there's no H in Russian.
So oh, yeah, right.
It's pronounced as Galley. Mm-hmm. And originally, it was a French-Soviet collaboration, and it was going to be a large balloon on two orbiters, and that would have deployed two landers, one each. And one of them, the landers would have deployed a balloon and float in the atmosphere. But then came along Comet Halley, of course, in 1984, and the Russians decided that they would rather send the mother spacecraft to observe Halley. So they had to reduce the size of the balloon.
They wouldn't get another chance for 75 years.
Right. So they ended up launching two spacecraft. So there were two flyby spacecraft, two landers, Vega 1 and Vega 2, and two balloons that entered the Venus atmosphere. And surprisingly, one lander, when it was near 18 kilometers above the surface, roughly 12 miles, it experienced a massive updraft. It's described in the papers as tens of meters per second, which is unheard of.
What would have been the origin of that?
Well, we don't know, but, if it was a volcano erupting, it wouldn't be
Much of a balloon to report back.
Yeah, but the balloon was much higher. The balloons were floating 50 kilometers or about almost 35 kilometers above the surface. And because the atmosphere is mostly carbon dioxide, so it's a very heavy atmosphere. And what comes out of volcanoes is a lot of carbon dioxide, but also a lot of sulfur dioxide, at least on Earth. And sulfur dioxide is much heavier than carbon dioxide because of the two oxygen molecules and sulfur. So its molecular weight is 64. And so it's not easy to punch through a very thick atmosphere unless it's also extremely hot. And weather, and as it rises through the atmosphere, it'll of course cool off. But it's possible that the Vega balloon temperatures were detected to be consistently about 6.5 degrees centigrade warmer than the other balloons, which were floating, you know, fairly quietly for most of the part, except for some small updrafts and downdrafts when they flew over some small mountains down below, 35 miles below. But that anomaly, the difference between the two temperatures at the same, roughly the same altitude, has never been explained. But it's possible that they were trapped in a gas bubble, which may have had more warmer air and possibly a slightly different composition.
Do we have the sense, even imagining, fantasizing a bit, that Venus was ever a Goldilocks planet during its evolution?
I don't know. I don't know if Venus is past its prime or what. I think if some of the model simulations are right, then Venus probably did have a Goldilocks era sometime in the past. Michael Way and his colleagues have done some modeling, assuming there was liquid water, and that's where the debate is now, as I explained earlier.
If we assume that it did.
It did. Then they found that it could survive for as long as possibly 2 or 3 billion years. That's a lot longer than water could have ever existed on the surface of Mars. So that was behind our proposal that maybe bacteria did form on Venus, and they migrated to the clouds when the conditions on the surface became inclement, and are now responsible for some of the absorption of sunlight. I mean, that's the critical part that we still haven't solved yet. What is causing all that sunlight in the Venus atmosphere?
Well, because Venus, with such a heavy cloud layer, would presumably reflect the
yes,
sunlight?
Yes, that's why it's so bright. But in UV, we know the reflection is a lot less. So it is absorbing ultraviolet light below about 400 nanometers. So what is that absorber? That's the question that we've been after. And that's what led to the suggestion of bacteria. And other people have taken it up and proposed a life cycle, Sarah Seeger, and they are now proposing a series of three missions called the Venus Life Finder mission. And their first mission is about to be launched in May 2023 from the recent report.
Well, let's get some notion of the surface of Venus and some of its other characteristics, let's say, peculiarities from an Earth standpoint when mm-hmm. we return in a moment. This mm-hmm. is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Sanjay LeMay, and we're talking about the planet Venus and new discoveries about that mysterious closest planetary neighbor to the Earth. You mentioned early on, Sanjay, that the conditions on the surface of Venus and in the atmosphere, for that matter, are hardly hospitable when it comes to conditions that we're accustomed to on Earth. So when we're talking about measuring things on the surface of Venus, what kind of instruments can do that? How long do they last under that extreme heat and pressure?
The pressure is not too much of a problem. You can build pressure vessels, just like people are able to go deep diving in the Earth oceans. The temperature is the main problem. Most electronics, like, you know, what we are using today, not the vacuum tube technology of the past era, especially since we are in a radio station here, the first station I had transmitters built out of vacuum tubes. So those vacuum tubes will work well on Venus. Unfortunately, we can't find any manufacturers these days. The semiconductor electronics that are used everywhere now, they don't operate comfortably beyond about 50, 60 degrees centigrade. And even if you use thermal protection, insulation, basically, you can't keep the heat out. The longest probe that has survived on Venus and transmitted data is about 1 hour from the surface, and that's after a descent time of almost 1 hour. So even though the probe enters very cold, the heat from the hypervelocity entry and the deceleration causes the outside to warm up. So probes going into Venus atmosphere have to use thermal tiles, thermal protection tiles, just like the space shuttle used to do. And even then, survival on the surface for electronics is hard. The battery's power is the main problem because Venus is so cloudy, you cannot use solar cells as we do on Mars rovers, for example. One possibility is radioisotope generators that the Mars rovers are using. But they're complicated and also not clear if they would survive under those high temperatures. But there are some chemicals that provide power, salt-based, like potassium salts, for example. They've been used to construct some batteries that have been shown to survive under Venus surface conditions for several months now. And the NASA Glenn Research Center has a team, Tibor Kremik, Gary Hunter, and many other engineers. They've been working on it for the last few years, and they have a concept for a lander that could last for several months, maybe 3 or 4 months on the surface of Venus and send data. They've been successful at building the batteries and some rudimentary electronics even. I don't know if they have reached the stage of creating a transmitter yet, but they hope that they will be successful, and maybe in the next few years we'll see some long-lived stations on the surface of Venus.
Where would they land?
Right now, that's a good question. Myself being an atmospheric scientist, it doesn't matter to me where they land. They may have imagers that may operate at that point under those conditions, at least for a short while. But really, you know, the surface of Venus shows so many different morphologies compared to Mars that almost anywhere you land would be perfect.
Oh, really? You don't have a problem with, like, landing in molten lava or something?
Well, there's always that chance. I mean, recent suggestions are that Venus may be volcanically active even today, low level of activity, you know, something like the Hawaiian volcanoes for many years until they started erupting, the Mauna Loa, for example, or Mauna Kea.
What kind of surface does it have, as far as we know so far?
We do have a few pictures of the Venus surface from the Soviet probes. Venera 9 and 10 and 13 and 14 sent pictures back from the surface. And it looks kind of interesting that you would expect on a rocky planet. You can see flat rocks, you can see pebbles a few centimeters in size, you can see dust. In fact, dust was seen in a sequence of images taken from Venera 13, 14 landers. You can detect the signal of the dust rising up and falling down back on the lander.
Impressive.
And they were even in color. Of course, when it comes to color, the problem is how do you correct for the atmosphere if the thick clouds take away most of the blue light? So the surface should look kind of yellowish, reddish. They did carry a color chart, so to speak, on both the landers, and they tried to correct for it. But we don't really know what the true color is. But it's mostly grayish, people expect. The sky might appear kind of yellowish, orangish, based on some of the data that we have analyzed. But these pictures, because they were panoramas taken from the surface, they don't really tell us much more about the rest of the planet. You know, I mean, if you look at the volcanic features on Venus, there are amazing number of variety. You know, you find volcanoes that look spider-like. There are double-walled craters. There are pancake volcanoes. They look literally like pancakes.
That's different.
Then there are some impact craters. Because of the atmosphere's thickness, only large objects can make it down to the surface. But, yes, you can see ejecta from the impacts, and you can see the central peaks in several spots from the Magellan and the 15, 16 radars. But the new radars going out in the next decade, I think they'll have much higher resolution, and we can do much more with the data and learn about the surface than what we've been able to so far.
Not much for seasons, I gather, because the axis is tilted only, what, about 3 degrees as compared to 26 for the Earth?
Right. And so if you're on the surface, then you'll have days about 58 and a half Earth days long and nights equally long. And at the poles, you'll be in more or less permanent shadow except for, you know, a very small illumination because of the low sun being low in the sky.
What will Venus, these discoveries on Venus, tell us about the outer planets, the exoplanets?
Well, that's interesting. You know, the James Webb Telescope that was launched just about a month ago, I guess, December 25th, I recall. It has now been fully deployed, and I think they're going through the paces to turn the instruments on and focus the telescopes, etc. It has 4 instruments. And one of the targets for JWST is to look at exoplanets, especially the habitable exoplanets. As you know, in the last few years, thousands of planets have been discovered around other stars. And we are learning a lot more about the conditions on the atmosphere-bearing planets. But most of that information comes through spectroscopy. That is, we are looking at the light coming from the planet as it transits through the atmosphere of the planet and is detected by observatories like Hubble or other observatories on the ground. And James Webb Space Telescope will do the same thing except in infrared. That's where it is easier to detect some complex molecules through spectroscopy. However, looking at Venus, we know that we can't learn everything there is to know or answer all the questions we have about a planet just through spectroscopy. I mean, that's why we are still sending missions to Venus and planning for more of, beyond the next decade. So if you don't understand Venus, then it'll be difficult to understand exoplanets, especially get any confidence that our inferences are right. Because if you look at the history of astronomy, you know, people have been looking at planets like Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, and the moons of Jupiter for a long time. And spectroscopy goes only so far. You know, it will reach a certain limit where the observations become too difficult to disentangle. That's something that we have learned by looking at Venus.
I'm curious as to how it could come about that Venus is spinning in the opposite direction of most of the other planets in the solar system. Does that have to do with just the way the planet was – were the planets spun out of the sun? Is that the prevailing theory?
The solar nebula and the planets roughly coalesced into their current earlier states at about the same time. So the sun formed from a cloud of dust and gas. And it became a star before the other debris coalesced and formed planets. But the planets were not always in the same position. The outer planets in particular, they were in very different orbits, and many of them have shifted orbits and their positions in their evolution. So since the original dust cloud was spinning, we expect that all the planets should have the same spin orientation.
Yeah.
And to a large degree, that's true. Most of the planets do, except for some strange objects like Uranus and Venus. Well, Uranus probably had an impact with another large object and got tipped. I mean, that's what happened to Earth. That could have led to the formation of the moon when Earth was only about 50 to 100 million years old. And at that point, Earth was spinning much faster, maybe 5 to 6 hours instead of the current 24.
Boy,
and it's the moon that has regulated the spin period. So did Venus have a moon? Did it have multiple impacts? We don't really know. But it's possible that Venus did not need impacts, and it could have started spinning backwards just through the action of the atmospheric tides caused by the thickness of the atmosphere and the interaction with the surface.
Is it inevitable that the planets would all go around the sun in the same direction, though?
Well, the orbits are in the same direction. I mean, we haven't seen any planets that go backwards. Only periodic visitors from outer space, they go in the wrong direction. Like, I think the most recent comet, I believe that was in a retrograde orbit. There have been a few such visitors from beyond the solar system. But all the planets are moving in the same direction. And how Venus started spinning backwards, that's still an open question. It turns out that the rotation rate is not constant. That is, the length of the day on Venus changes, just like it changes on Earth, except that the changes on Venus are a few minutes, maybe tens of minutes, over the last few decades compared to hundreds of milliseconds or so on Earth every day, for example. So we don't know what the rate was in ancient past. Was it spinning the same way as it did? If it did, then it would certainly require multiple impacts by small objects or big objects to turn it upside down. But that's one of the mysteries of Venus. Why does it spin backwards? And there are not very many tools that we have that we can use to find out what the rotation rate was in the ancient past.
Before we part, a few words about your work with the Russians, quite a bit of it.
Well, the Russians started exploring Venus, and they were fortunate enough that their government allowed them to send missions to Venus, whether they failed or not, or succeeded, I mean, that is. And so they just kept launching and improving technology, whereas in the U.S., the situation was different. After Mariner 2, one had failed, it ended up in the ocean. Two succeeded. I don't remember what happened to Mariner 3. Four went to Mars, five went to Venus, and then came Mariner 10, and then there was a long pause until Pioneer Venus Orbiter and multi-probe mission was launched in 78. And then there was a drought until Magellan came along. And after Magellan, we haven't had a mission to Venus until the recent selections of two missions. But they came out only because of the hoopla about phosphine and the community pressure that NASA was probably feeling, having invested tens of billions of dollars in exploring Mars, for example, and trying to bring samples back. So way back around 2001, the Russians had planned a long-lived mission on Venus, Dolgozhayushchaya, that was the name. That's why it's called Venera D. It's not like Venera A, B, C, D, like the Japanese, which was first planet A was the mission to Venus. Well, that didn't happen. Then planet B, that became Nozomi, the Mars mission. And then it was planet C, and that was picked as the Venus mission. So planet C was the JAXA mission. But Venera D is different. D stands for Dolgozhayushchaya, the long-lived mission. And they had hoped to have a lander that would have survived for about 30 days. And back in those days, they would just come to some of the meetings and say, we invite all the scientists to work with us and submit instruments and so on and so forth. But that didn't go very far. And then around 2008 or 9, NASA formed a study team to look at a large, what they call a flagship class mission, like a multi-billion dollar mission. And we had one or two Russians on that team, and they described the concept for this Venera D mission, an orbiter, two orbiters, two landers, and two balloons. And we were considering similar ideas in the U.S. To propose to NASA. And that led to the dialogue when I became chair of the Venus Exploration Analysis Group. I approached Russians to see if somehow we could collaborate, because it was becoming too expensive or affordable for a large mission within the U.S., within NASA. And so that led to the formation of a study team and became known as the Venera D Joint Science Definition Team. And then, of course, the political situation worsened with the Crimea crisis, and we were told to stop. And then at higher level, there were some interventions, because, as you know, there is still the collaboration between the two countries on the International Space Station. And so this was seen as one more possibility to expand the collaboration. And so it continues, and we hope that the two countries will still collaborate on exploring Venus in the future, despite what's happening on the political front today.
Some irony there, isn't there?
Yes, it is.
It's so rough on the surface of Earth, relatively smooth on the surface of Venus, at least as far as research is concerned.
Yeah, you know, I mean, there's no monopoly on having great ideas.
Well, Sanjay LeMay, thank you for sharing some of your great ideas and ideas of your cohorts and your predecessors regarding the planet Venus.
Thank you very much, Norman. It's been a pleasure.
I'm Norman Gilliland, and I hope you can join me next time around for University of the Air.